Greetings and vaudevillian vacillations, my centrolucically eudoric listeners, and welcome to this October 2018 Science News Update. I'm your host for this modestly stentorous science podcast segment, Jim Campanella. So every time you think that the idiot scientist stories of the month have run out, you find a new one. Just in time for the announcement of the Nobel Prizes this month, here is a story about one of this year's Nobel Prize winners, who appears to lack, let's say, common sense. According to The Guardian, a bizarre video has surfaced on YouTube featuring one of this year's physics Nobel winners, Dr. Gerard Moreau. I've seen it online, and it is, well, it's something. The clip is titled, "Have You Seen Eli?" It was made in 2013, and apparently with the aim of promoting extreme light infrastructure, ELI, an 850 million euro project led by Moreau. The lyrics to the soundtrack, an upbeat reggae song, list the exciting goals of the laser facility: reversing nuclear waste, understanding the universe, and, yes, even healing cancer. Sounds great, huh? Well, the actual video is, well, less great. In the accompanying footage, Moreau and colleague Dr. Jean-Paul Chambaret are dancing in the laser lab, apparently surrounded by a troop of female students. Two of the women fling off their semi-transparent lab coats to reveal white underwear underneath in an unexpected striptease. The men wearing reflective laser goggles strike macho poses. The two professors are also seen at the front of a lecture theater teaching a class of students, one of whom, a young woman, lowers her eyelids at Moreau to reveal the words, "I love Eli," a la Raiders of the Lost Ark. Then, this being France, everybody gets up and dances, some looking slightly awkward. Moreau then appears in a flashy BMW convertible, running his hand over his silver hair as he arrives at the laser facility. It's not clear who funded the production. According to The Guardian, the French National Laboratory and funding agency denied any involvement. A spokesman for the funding agency said, quote, "This video was made at the sole personal initiative of the researcher and his team, and our institution never relayed this video." Moreover, many people at the French National Laboratory and funding agency believe it is inappropriate to promote science in this way, unquote. I disagree. There's nothing wrong with promoting science in the videos, as long as it's done tastefully. Moreau said in a statement, quote, "I am sincerely and profoundly sorry for the image conveyed by this video. At the time this video was made, the objective was to popularize the research being done within the framework of the ELI project and to break down the austerity that the field of science can sometimes transmit." He continues with, quote, "It is important that the scientific community recognize the role as well as the importance of each and every researcher, regardless of gender," unquote. The video was said to have been widely circulated in the laser physics community. Again, according to The Guardian, Dr. Jessica Wade, a physicist at Imperial College London, said, quote, "That idiotic four-minute clip managed to capture a lot of what is wrong with research, including hero worship of professors, bizarre power relationships, and sexism. I've not been a scientist for a long time, but so far I haven't met any professors who spend their days walking around research centers surrounded by half-naked dancing girls in lab coats," unquote. Dancing girls would probably just get in the way, Dr. Wade. I suspect more labs would probably have them around. Anyway, the actual first story of the night is for all those of you listeners who complained last month that I had no stories outside of biology. This report concerns a new first in astronomy. The first exomoon has been detected. Yes, the first suspected exomoon was detected by Doctors David Kipping and Alex Tichy of Columbia University. They used the Hubble Space Telescope to visualize a Neptune-sized moon orbiting a gas giant exoplanet 8,000 light-years away. That news was reported October 3rd in the journal Science Advances. The moon's existence, if confirmed, may challenge theories of how satellites are born. Kipping and Tichy pointed the aging and soon-to-be-retired Hubble scope at the star Kepler-1625 for 40 hours on October 28th and 29th, 2017. The star was known to have a Jupiter-sized planet orbiting it every 287 days, thanks to earlier observations by the Kepler Space Telescope, which detects dips in starlight, and indicated that a planet was transiting in front of the star. The two scientists had seen signs in the Kepler data of a second dimming, either before or after the planet passed, exactly what they would expect if an exomoon were orbiting that planet. The pair named the putative moon Kepler-1625b1, or Neptmoon for short. But the researchers need more observations to be really sure that it is a moon, not another planet, or some sort of activity on the star. The Hubble telescope is about four times more sensitive to light than the Kepler telescope, so using the Hubble, Kipping and Tichy spotted a secondary dip in light after the planet crossed the star. The planet also started its 19-hour transit 77.8 minutes earlier than expected, suggesting that something was gravitationally dragging on the planet. Both the signals detected are consistent with the so-called Neptmoon existing. Tichy says, quote, "However, we are not cracking open champagne bottles just yet. We want to check with the Hubble again, hopefully during the next transit next year in May 2019. Things look very exciting and tantalizing and maybe even compelling," unquote. One reason for the caution of Kipping and Tichy is the strangeness of the moon itself. According to their paper, in our solar system, moons form in only one of three ways. First, by being kicked out of a planet itself by a massive impact. Second, by coalescing from gas and rock orbiting the planet. Or third, by being captured by the planet's gravity from elsewhere. Kepler-1625b1 is a gas giant as big as Neptune. I mean, that's huge. There is nothing in this solar system in the least like that, and it's unclear how those three scenarios could create a moon as big as Kepler-1625b1. Tichy finishes with, quote, "Kepler-1625b1, if real, would be about 10 times as massive as the mass of all the moons and terrestrial planets in the solar system combined. This suggests that this moon would have formed in a completely different way than any moon in the solar system." Unquote. Speaking of exomoons and exoplanets, there was a story out of NASA at the end of September that relates to those searches. According to a NASA press release, the next exoplanet hunt is officially on. NASA's Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite, TESS, which launched in April, has taken its first wide-sky science image and has confirmed its first exoplanet. Wahoo! Another one! So TESS spotted a new planet being called Pi Min C, crossing in front of its bright sun-like star about 60 light-years from Earth, and it blocked a bit of starlight. The data was collected from July 25th to August 22nd, and that transit revealed that the planet is a bit more than about two times the Earth's radius, and it quickly orbits its star about every 6.27 days. The researchers found previously unnoticed evidence of the planet in data from the HARPS spectrograph and the Anglo-Australian Planet Search, which have monitored the star Pi Mensae over the past 20 years. Those observations show how the planet's gravity tugs on the star, letting researchers determine that the planet's mass is about 4.8 times that of Earth. The Anglo-Australian Planet Search also previously revealed another planet, and this one was about 10 times the mass of Jupiter, orbiting Pi Mensae every 5.7 years. Combining the new Earth-sized planet's mass and radius shows that it has a similar density to pure water, although the test team warns, quote, though of course we should not imagine the planet to be a globe of water. It probably has a core made of iron and rock, surrounded by an ocean or atmosphere of lighter materials like water, methane, hydrogen, and helium, unquote. The next story we have actually discussed previously. It's a bit controversial, and I have my own opinions on why it has been so unsuccessful, but I suspect you have your own as well. What am I talking about? SETI, our search for extraterrestrial life. Previous stories that I have reported have suggested that humans have not contacted aliens because it is likely many civilizations go dark quickly or simply do not age well and they cannot contact us. Well, Dr. Jason Wright of Penn State suggests in a paper posted in September at the online journal archive.org that we have probably seen no aliens yet using SETI because we are simply so amazingly inefficient at it, even after 60 years. Wright's new calculations show that if space is an ocean, then we've barely dipped in a toe. The volume of observable space, home so far for SETI, says Wright, is comparable to searching the volume of a large hot tub for evidence of fish in Earth's oceans. Basically, if you pulled out a random hot tub's worth of water in the ocean, you wouldn't always expect to see a fish. In 2010, SETI astronomer Dr. Jill Tarter imagined a quote-unquote cosmic haystack of naturally occurring radio waves she could sift through for the proverbial needle of an artificial alien beacon. Her haystack went beyond physical space to include factors such as an impossible signal's duration, frequency, variations, and strength, as well as the sensitivity of radio telescopes on Earth that would presumably detect a signal. Why am I even mentioning Tarter? Well, she concluded that searches that had been done had covered about a drinking glass worth of seawater, way less than even Wright calculated. Well, Wright has updated Tarter's calculation by devising a slightly different haystack, including factors like frequency and bandwidth aliens might broadcast in. It also included more recent SETI searches. Converting the volume to liters for the sake of analogy, Wright concluded that SETI has covered the equivalent of about 7,700 liters out of about 1.335 billion trillion liters of water in the Earth's oceans. But hey, it's more than a drinking glass full, right? Wright concludes with, quote, we're finally getting to the point today that we have a chance of finding something depending on how much there is to find, unquote. The next story brings us back to biology. So back in the mid-90s, before the Human Genome Project was really getting started, if you asked any scientist how many genes the human genome has, you would have probably gotten an answer of anywhere between 50,000 to over 100,000. And that's a pretty big range. And that was because we did not know yet how many genes there were, but we had a pretty good idea, though still in complete view, of how many proteins are made in a human cell, or how many mRNA transcripts are produced. And yes, those are both pretty big numbers. It turned out years later, when the human genome was finally sequenced, that the number was far lower than anybody had figured originally. It was first pegged at about 25,000. But even that number has been argued about for the last 10 years or so. It turns out that a single gene may make several different proteins because of a phenomenon called alternative transcript splicing. That means that a single messenger mRNA may be chopped up in several different ways to give you different proteins. That's why those 1990s scientists thought there were so many genes and messenger mRNAs around. They knew nothing of alternative splicing at the time. But, as you can readily tell, it turns out now that figuring out how many genes are in the human genetic instruction manual isn't as easy as those scientists once thought. Also, to make things even more complicated, the very definition of a gene has changed since the completion of the Human Genome Project more than 15 years ago. Genes used to be defined as stretches of DNA that contained instructions that copied into RNA and then got turned into proteins. As I said earlier, researchers still don't entirely agree on how many of these protein-coding genes there are. Dr. Steve Salzberg of Johns Hopkins has now published a new gene count of 21,306, which was published August 30th in BNC Biology. But in the last decade, researchers have learned that not all genes produce proteins. Many scientists have expanded the definition of a gene to include those that make RNAs that, instead of being turned into proteins, have other functions in the cell. Salzberg says, quote, numbers of RNA-producing genes, also called non-coding genes, are even more up in the air than protein-coding genes. We have already found more of these RNA genes, 25,525, than protein-coding ones, and our count doesn't even include microRNAs and other recently discovered small RNAs, unquote. MicroRNAs and small interfering RNAs, called siRNAs, are short regulatory sequences that are regularly produced to control whether messenger RNAs are translated or not. And even without those small RNAs and siRNAs, which he is not counting, Salzberg's new total of human genes comes to at least 46,831. Other scientists have debated the estimate, but Salzberg says, quote, I will not be surprised if 10 years from now we still don't have an agreed-upon number, unquote. All righty. This next story is just one of those that annoys me. I'm not sure whether it will turn out to be true or not, but I just find it entirely irksome. Why? Because this is another story that suggests that the human microbiome controls the human body. I feel like I've been covering these stories for years, and yet here is another. If we are to believe half the reports, then we are just zombies that bacteria control for their own benefit. So what is the newest mess? Could disinfectants that we commonly use to clean our homes cause our children to become overweight? Dr. Anita Kozerski of the University of Alberta and leader of the Canadian Healthy Infant Longitudinal Development Study, CHILD, analyzed the gut microbiota of more than 750 children aged 3 to 4 months and looked at the kids' exposure to disinfectant, detergents, and so-called eco-friendly cleaning products used in the home. After controlling for a wide range of other potential factors, her results suggested a clear dose-dependent link between the mother's reported use of disinfectant in the home, changes in the level of some types of normal gut bacteria in their infants, and the kid's weight at age 1 to 3 years. In contrast, eco-friendly cleaning products didn't increase the likelihood of children becoming overweight. Kozerski says in this long quote, quote, we found that infants living in households with disinfectants being used at least weekly were twice as likely to have higher levels of gut microbes, Lactobacillus, at age 3 to 4 months. When they were 3 years old, their body mass index was higher than children not exposed to heavy use of disinfectants as infants, unquote. Kozerski and her group report their results in the Canadian Medical Association Journal in a paper titled Postnatal Exposure to Household Disinfectants, Infant Gut Microbiota, and Subsequent Risk of Overweight in Children. I guess what annoys me about this article is less the idea that environmental toxins affect us adversely than the idea that everything is now linkable to the microbiome. Kozerski says, infancy is the key time in microbiome development. Quote, we start with a fewer number of species and they increase over the first year of life. The different kinds of species increase, some decrease. By the time we're 3 years old, we each have a microbiome that we can call our own and which remains with us throughout life. Microbiome changes caused by some environmental factors, such as antibiotics, can change that microbiome, but they tend to be transitory and normal childhood pattern is resumed. Frequent home use of disinfectants can alter that development and balance, unquote. Kozierski says she found frequent use of disinfectant as high as once daily increased the chance of an infant having higher levels of a particular bacteria, Lactobacillus in their gut, and also increased the risk of the infants becoming overweight by age 3. And here is where Kozierski's data really starts to make my head hurt. She says that the link between eco-friendly product use, reduced fecal Enterobacteriaceae abundance, and reduced incidence of overweight at age 3 didn't appear causal. What? So using disinfectants and getting fat babies is causal, but not using them and getting skinny babies is not. I'm very confused by this. She knows, quote, those infants growing up in households with heavy use of eco cleaners had lower levels of gut microbes, Enterobacteriaceae. However, we found no evidence that these gut microbiome changes caused the reduced obesity risk. Our analyses were controlled for other well-known factors that affect microbiota, so it wasn't those factors that explained any of the results we obtained. In the case of the eco-friendly products, I must admit we were a bit surprised, unquote. And apparently they weren't just surprised, they were confused. Okay. I suppose whether those results make any sense or not, it's probably a good idea to use less disinfectant around babies. Any extra chemical that a baby is exposed to, it can't be good for it. I know it's hard to believe, but dirt is good for a baby's immune system. Yes, good. Now, don't get carried away with that concept. I mean, there is not being worried about a bit of dirt, and then there's just being psychotic about the use of cleaning products. Anyway, last story of the night is a bit of good news from the cancer therapy side of science. If you've known anybody with pancreatic cancer, you know how horrible that is. Pancreatic cancer is one of the most recalcitrant cancer types that are known, and the survival rate has been abysmal for years. Well, that may be changing. This year, about 55,000 people in the U.S. will be diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, and more than about 44,000 of them will die. That makes it one of the deadliest cancers there is. Currently, the pancreatic cancer 5-year survival rate is only 7%, and drugs to treat this aggressive disease are limited and, in the main, pretty ineffectual. However, now Dr. Mouad Ederkoy and his crew from the Cancer Institute of Cedars-Sinai may have found a reason to be hopeful, as results from their new study show that a newly developed drug called Medivert, can prevent the most common type of pancreatic cancer from growing and spreading, at least in laboratory mice. The findings from this new study, published last month in Gastroenterology, were in an article entitled, "An inhibitor of GSK3B and HDAC kills pancreatic cancer cells and slows pancreatic tumor growth and metastasis in mice." The journal article demonstrated that Medivert could prevent patients from developing a resistance to currently used pancreatic cancer chemotherapies. Ederkoy explains, quote, "This is an exciting step toward improving survival rates in pancreatic cancer patients. If the results are confirmed in humans, we could have a drug with the potential to significantly extend the lives of patients with pancreatic ductal adenocarcinoma, which is very difficult to treat," unquote. 95% of pancreatic cancer patients are diagnosed with pancreatic ductal adenocarcinoma, which develops from cells lining the small tubes of the pancreas. Pancreatic ductal adenocarcinoma can be difficult to treat because the cancer cells prompt normal cells that reside in the pancreas, called stellate cells, to produce pancreatic scar tissue. And the scar tissue makes it difficult for chemotherapy agents and blood to enter the pancreas. The cancer and stellate cell interaction also creates an environment that stimulates local tumor growth
and cancer spread to different sites in the body. Additionally, the activity levels of certain enzymes rev up, fueling resistance to cancer treatments. Ettercoy says that, quote, Metaverse significantly reduced survival of pancreatic ductal adenocarcinoma cells. Cells incubated with Metavert in combination with irradiation and paclitaxel and gemcitabine have reduced survival compared to cells incubated with either agent alone. Metavert increased killing of drug-resistant pancreatic ductal adenocarcinoma cells by paclitaxel and gemcitabine. Unquote. Over a four-year period, the investigators designed and synthesized new chemicals that inhibit cancer cell activity. They discovered that Metavert blocked drug resistance and also significantly boosted the positive effects of radiation and those two chemotherapy agents that he mentioned in the quote. In one of the mouse studies, Metavert increased the survival rate by about 50%. The authors conclude, quote, In studies of pancreatic ductal adenocarcinoma cells and two mouse models, we found Metavert to induce cancer cell apoptosis, reduce migration and expression of stem cell markers, and slow growth of tumor and metastases. We are now working to develop a version of the drug to test in humans. Sounds great. Well, that's all for me for now. Keep counting those human genes. Don't count your moons before they're hatched. Keep watching the skies, and I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.